So, we had a lot of demands of Google yesterday, isn't that right?
Yes, we did. Our team did.
Yeah, it just so happened that we published two pieces, one in which we kind of criticized Google for dropping the ball on a feature that was announced at Google I.O. last year, and the other being me kind of demanding a feature for the Pixel 3. I guess both of these things are kind of related to the Pixel 3. I mean, the first of which, the image obstruction removal feature, which Google announced at Google I.O.
I.O.
Yes, at I.O. Last year. Sundar Pichai said on stage that this new feature would be coming very soon. Basically, for those who aren't aware, it basically lets you take a photo, and I guess in post-processing, it will remove any obvious obstructions. The example that Google used on stage was a chain link fence. So theoretically, in this futuristic world, which we're hoping is coming very soon, you could take a photo, you know, of your kid playing baseball or something through a chain link fence, and Google Photos or the Pixel, we can talk about that in a second, will erase basically the obstruction in the way and kind of use machine learning to basically fill in those gaps with, you know, what it would see, what it would think the photo would look like without the obstruction in the way.
So Google made a big deal about this. That it was in the first 10 minutes of the I/O 2017 keynote. And they were talking about how they have such a lead in image processing and computer vision capabilities. And as you were saying, Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, said it was coming very soon, and it has not happened.
Yeah, here we are, March 30th of the following year, and we've just heard nothing about it.
So, and we're close to the next I.O. So, actually, in December, in our APK Insight of Google Photos version 3.10, we saw some references to image obstruction and the ability to, and this, what we assume, was the feature that Sundar Pichai announced. But very quickly after we uncovered it, Google removed it in the next version. And it's been gone since. So it's really surprising. One, because that was in December, and that is not very soon for May. And two, that right now, there is no word about it.
Well, since you were the one that did the teardown with Dylan, I guess I have to ask you, do we know for sure that those strings were referencing this specific feature? Or
the strings themselves directly mentioned obstruction types like refraction and occlusion, and in our opinion at the time, and we still believe that was the only thing we were confident about, that what it could be.
Right, so we don't know for sure, but it seems likely at least. So we definitely think that this is a Google Photos feature.
Yes. But, of course, there's always the possibility that it is a Pixel exclusive. The way that Sundar announced it on stage was right after he talked about the low-light performance that Google was doing with the original Pixel. And they were so close together that we really can't tell whether it's a general Photos feature or it's a Pixel one.
Yeah, it was pretty hard to tell, I think, to determine whether or not he was kind of inferring that this was going to be for just the Pixel, since, you know, it was mentioned directly in line after mentioning the Pixel-specific functionality. Basically, this whole section, he was talking about, you know, how machine learning is transforming all of Google's products, and, you know, how Google is becoming and is, in a lot of ways, a machine learning-first company. And, you know, this part of the presentation was directly in line after mentioning how machine learning has transformed the Google Pixel line, the Pixel's ability to take low-light photos. And so, I mean, I could see this theoretically being a Pixel 3 exclusive. I mean, if you were at the event, you know that whenever Sundar, you know, talked about this, everyone in the stadium was just like agape. Basically, their mouths were agape, like amazed at this. I mean, it's not all that, you know, groundbreaking, but it is, you know, one of those features that makes you, you know, say, wow, that's really cool. And it's, I think, one of those things that Google is uniquely positioned, I think, to deliver it to a wide, you know, breadth of consumers.
Definitely. And when you said very cool, I think that's why it has to be in Google Photos, because everybody loves Google Photos. Android users, iOS users, even those with who take pictures with DSLRs. Just imagine if this feature just came to the web, what a great attraction that would be.
Yeah, I think it's a really good showcase of what Google can do. You know, showing up on the web, showing up on iOS devices. If this theoretically was, you know, just another item for the assistant feed in Google Photos, you know, something that you don't really have to think about, because like we were talking about this before the show, but you were saying it would be really troublesome if this were in the camera app and you had to choose a specific mode to take advantage of, you know, this obstruction removal thing. But if it were something that happened after the fact in Google Photos, if Google Photos was able to automatically detect that a photo had a chain link fence in the foreground and remove it for you, then this could be just another option in the assistant feed. They could say, hey, we saw this photo has a chain link fence in it. We thought we'd remove it for you. And if you want to save this new photo that we made for you, you can just tap a button. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it would be, you know, one of those features. Like Google's known for doing this, where, you know, they have these features that kind of showcase what they're capable of, and they add it to their products that work across platforms to kind of draw people in.
Yeah. In other things, we were talking about wireless charging. Well, you were talking about how you really wanted wireless charging on the Pixel 3.
Yeah, I mean, I think more than just wireless charging as a feature, I want everything to be wireless charging, I think, which is, you know, kind of a bigger demand than just saying, hey, like, I would really like Google to add this piece of hardware to a phone. I kind of am just really envious of the entire AirPower situation that Apple's doing, with this pad that can charge a phone, a watch, and the AirPods, you know, all in one place. The way things are right now with Wear OS and with the Pixel still being kind of a niche product in the bigger picture, in terms of, you know, from consumers' perspective, and, you know, Google not really having a true AirPods competitor, you know, Pixel Buds get close, but I don't think that they provide the same level of streamlined experience that the AirPods do. This entire picture that Apple's painting with these three products and working on just one wireless charging pad is really attractive, I think, to not just me, but to consumers in general. And, you know, that's what I really want. You know, the Pixel 3 getting wireless charging would be just one piece of that. And my argument with it, with the Pixel 3 at least, is, you know, Apple is now, you know, putting out this really great wireless charging solution for all of its products. But wireless charging, Qi charging has been traditionally an Android thing, right?
Yeah. The history goes far back.
Yeah, I mean, we have, you know, all the way back to, I think the LG G2 had wireless charging, you know, with Palm devices with the touch, what was it called? The Touchstone. Yeah, Touchstone.
Beautiful Touchstone.
Yes. And then on Google's side of things, some people were questioning me on saying, can we bring back wireless charging, as if Pixel phones ever had wireless charging? I'm well aware that I'm well aware that the Pixel and the Pixel 2 don't have wireless charging. What I was referring to was the several Nexus phones, which had, you know, wireless charging, which are the spiritual precursors to the Pixel phones, I think, in many ways. The Nexus 4 was the original, but the first Nexus to have wireless charging. And then the Nexus 5 followed up, made by LG, also had wireless charging. And then the Nexus 6, made by Motorola, also had wireless charging. And then with the Nexus 5X and Nexus 6P, Google, you know, decided that they were going to...
USB-C was enough.
They decided that wired USB-C was enough maybe not enough for everyone, but the argument was basically that it was good enough that they could compromise and just not worry about the whole wireless thing as much. And I think that's interesting because, you know, in a way, at that time, before Google, before Apple came out with the iPhone X with wireless charging, you know, the wireless charging standards war, even a couple of years ago, was still raging with, you know, PowerMat and their standard versus Qi and their standard. And after the iPhone X, PowerMat said, well, I guess we lost. And so now PowerMat is adding Qi capabilities to all their hardware, which is installed at Starbucks and airports and plenty of other places. So the game, yep, the game has kind of changed now.
Yeah, you, as you noted in your piece, the ubiquity of it is so far and wide now. It is the perfect time for everybody to add wireless charging to their devices. And it's...
Yeah, and I think for Google, it, you know, it's a good opportunity for them to say, hey, yeah, we know we did this before. You, everyone knows Android phones have been where you get wireless charging if you wanted it. You know, beforehand, it was kind of one of those features that, you know, you had to weigh your options across the half a dozen different good Android phones to pick from. But now it would be really great if Google came out and said, yeah, we did this in the past. And we're really doubling down on it now. And we think it has legs, which I think it does. I think wireless charging has legs. I think that in the coming years, we're going to see it become fast enough and convenient enough that, you know, we'll all have furniture with wireless charging pads on them, and charging will be fast enough, or it will get faster, kind of approaching the speeds we currently have with wired.
So Starbucks has had these pads built into the tables for a while. Have you ever used it?
No, because the only wireless charging phones that I've had in the past were Qi charging phones, and they don't work, or they didn't work until after the iPhone X.
When Starbucks first launched the feature, they had these funny ring-shaped adapters that connected to micro USB and probably lightning at the point. And it was really a weird solution because it was shaped like a key, ring-shaped on one end, and then you attach to your phone, and then you would just pick them up at the counter, and you just attach to your phone, and it was the funniest looking solution ever.
Yeah, I mean, wires are probably more convenient than that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, I digress. I think, you know, Google at this point, it's March, you know, the phone's going to launch September, October probably, so I think the hardware specs for the Pixel 3 have already been pretty much nailed down at this point, you know, or if not, we're getting very close. And so it's kind of probably a pointless effort for me to be asking for this at this point, but, you know, I hope that we'll see it. Moving on, I think it's probably a good idea we talk about something else that's kind of, sort of, potentially related to, you know, the coming generation of Pixel phones, which is that Google, we found out very recently, is testing a new Pixel launcher search bar for, I guess, these upcoming devices, right?
Yes. So the folks at XDA found that on the Pixel launcher released with the Android P developer preview, there was an option to enable two bubbles. So at the bottom of the Pixel launcher, there's the search bar, and there's a new microphone icon that launches Assistant. This is how it's currently. But if you activate this flag of sorts, it separates it. It separates the microphone icon into its own bubble, and the search bar in its own thing. From a visual perspective, this definitely helps with making the icon more obvious and more clickable, and that it's a button that you should press to launch Assistant. But bubbles, they call it bubbles. Do you think this is an indication of where Google's going with Android P design, which we've talked about in length in past episodes, or is this just a one-off?
I'm not sure. I think it's clear that Google is embracing a variety of different kinds of bubbly looking things in the design language that they're kind of putting forward in Android P. I mean, if you look at the quick settings toggles in the first developer preview, I think that those are definitely more bubbly than the ones that we had before. So I don't know. I mean, I think we are seeing these very simple flat circular elements. Another place you can see them is the new icons and the colorful icons in the settings app. So maybe that's kind of what that might be kind of connected to or referring to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's clear that things are changing, so I'm not sure. On a related note, I heard from someone that there's actually a build of Android P floating around at Google that has a slightly revamped lock screen. Apparently, this version of the lock screen has calendar bubbles, or not bubbles, but calendar items listed kind of near the time, and that the time is just a little bit smaller than it currently is in the lock screen. I think that's interesting. I mean, it's just a little mini scoop that I'm just throwing in here, but I've really come to enjoy the written out calendar events that Google has on the home screen ever since the Pixel 2. And so I think it's really nice to see that Google is putting these calendar items on the lock screen as well. What do you think about it?
Yep, it seems that it might be an extension of the at-a-glance feature on the Pixel launcher that you're talking about. Who knows? It's from what you describe, it sounds very similar in concept and very similar in how Google wants to show you more useful information. It reminds me a lot of how in the Android 4.2, 4.3 days, you had widgets on the lock screen. And one of the most useful ones was the ability to add your calendar events. That, of course, disappeared after several versions, but it's nice that Google is experimenting with possibly putting it back in Android P.
Yeah, and I think possibly is the key word here. I mean, we've only heard about one Android P device that's running this or that has this feature. So this is, you know, like not entirely for certain going to be coming. If it does come, I wouldn't be surprised if we see it in a later, you know, build of Android P Developer Preview 2, maybe. I'm not sure. Obviously, Developer Preview 2 is coming at I.O. And as we saw last year, this Developer Preview 2 should have some significant additions over Developer Preview 1 that we haven't seen yet.
So yeah, that Developer Preview 2 is something to look forward to. Historically, that launches at I.O. and it jumps from an alpha to a beta, so we should definitely start seeing concrete features and possibly have it available to the Android beta program for a lot of users.
So with that mini scoop out of the way, I thought it might be a good idea to just introduce what this is. This is Alphabet Scoop for those who are tuning in for the first time. It's a new podcast from the team at 9to5 Google where we cover everything that's happening in Google from A to Z. So thanks for joining us. Basically, this show is where we share our own thoughts on the week's most important stories. And when possible, we'll have some rumors and mini scoops thrown in, like you just heard, based on the things we've heard. With that said, I think it's time we introduce ourselves. I'm Stephen Hall, and this is my colleague, Abner Lee. How are you doing today, Abner?
Good. It's been a month. This is our fourth episode, if you consider unofficial 000.
Yeah, officially, this is our third episode. However...
And nobody should ever go back and listen to that 000 episode. Just don't. I'm actively working to get it deleted from the site, but I've had some opposition, apparently.
Yeah, I think... Translation, we're getting better at this, hopefully. Hopefully you're noticing that we're slightly improving week over week. But, you know, in the long term, we hope to get to the point where things are, you know, smooth sailing. Beyond our Pixel 3 demands, which you just heard, this week was Apple's education event, and Google and Acer's hope to distract from it with the announcement of the Acer Chromebook Tab 10. That's a mouthful. The first Wear OS developer preview and lots of other important stories. So let's get started with that Chromebook tablet. So far, we have three names in official documentation: Google called them Chromebook tablets in their blog post. Acer called it a Chrome OS tablet in its press release. And now Acer's website, as we found today, says it's a Chromebook Tab, which I think is the most appropriate name, don't you think?
Yeah. And name aside, let's get into this tablet. This Chrome OS running tablet, which I am very, very excited for. Chrome OS is now on tablets, this portable form factor, after several years of convertibles. And basically, this Chrome OS tablet is if you take a convertible and just slice it in half, and you just get the screen. It is running the OP1 processor, which OP is Google's processor certification for Chromebooks. I believe it is made by Rocket Chip, with us previously seeing this chip on the Samsung Chromebook Plus, the ARM version. Actually, very amusingly, at the Apple event, there was a bit of a burn when they introduced the new iPad with the A10 Fusion, with Apple saying it's faster than virtually every Chromebook. So I wonder who Apple is afraid of in the education market. I'm sure we'll get into that after this. But that aside, the Acer Chromebook Tab 10, which is such a mouthful, as you were correct in pointing out, has 4 gigs of RAM, 32 gigs of storage. This is a full Chromebook, and that should be exciting. Other specs quickly are a 9.7-inch display at 2048x1536, a respectable 264 ppi, and on the ports front, it has USB-C, micro SD card slot for expansion, and a stylus, which was Apple's biggest feature of the new iPad, it getting support for the Apple Pencil. But Google and Acer actually include it in, and it doesn't require charging. And it's very cool how you can fit the stylus right into the bottom of the tablet, so it's portable, and you're not going to lose it, unlike the Apple Pencil, which the cap already comes off and rolls away, and that's an entire mess.
So how much does this thing cost?
It costs $329, which is the exact same price as the iPad.
The iPad, but not for education, because the new iPad selling for education markets, Apple's knocking off $30, right?
I have a point to pick with that, actually. Because Apple has always discounted their education products, if I remember correctly. So, is it a further $30 off? $299 for, like, education markets? I don't think so. So, what did they really announce?
Yeah, that's also a good point. I remember going to the Apple Store website whenever I was in middle school, even, you know, dreaming about potentially buying a MacBook. At the time, obviously, that was out of reach for me financially, but it was fun to go to the Apple Store website and click the, you know, for education section and find the name of my middle school or the school district or whatever it was and see, you know, how much closer I could get to potentially obtaining a $1,000 laptop as a 12-year-old.
I can so relate, but my dream was the truly refurbished section.
Yes. Actually, it's funny, this is unrelated, but my first laptop was an iBook G3 that I purchased from the school district when they were liquidating all of their old hardware. And I think I bought it for $99.
Dude, so, I got mine for free. I also have one. I have one, and it was running OS 9, and, like, even more crazy is that in 2010, that is how I watched the original iPad announcement on an iBook running OS 9 in a text view only live blog. Anyways, with the specs aside, what do you think of this tablet?
I mean, for me as a consumer, I'm not very interested, I don't think. I mean, I'm not really interested that much in tablets in general. I mean, we talked about how this is the first Chromebook tablet, after years of Google making Chromebook laptops, but it's also the first tablet from Google running a Google OS that's not an Android tablet. And Android tablets were never really compelling to me. I had a Nexus 9 and I had a Pixel C, with the keyboard. And, neither of them, I think Android as an OS, both from a performance perspective and just from a features, perspective on, productivity related features, it just wasn't up to par for me to even be enough really for me to write blog posts and stuff. It just felt too clunky and slow. The workflow just didn't feel good enough. And I'm not really sure, on a Chromebook tablet how that will be really that much improved. I mean, the entire, we can talk about this more when we talk about Chromebooks versus iPad in education, but the entire thing that's, compelling for me about a Chromebook, at least for my productivity, is having the keyboard. And so, like that's the thing. That's the selling point for me if I were to use a Chromebook as a daily driver. And taking that away leaves me with Android apps, running on Chrome OS in a browser. My productivity is primarily writing and typing, so overall, the tablet form factor is just not that appealing to me.
How about from a content consumption point of view, which is how I view this content consumption?
Is a Chrome OS tablet better than an Android tablet when it comes to content consumption? I don't think so. I mean, personally, for me, I like the Nexus 9 and I liked the Pixel C as content consumption devices. The time that I've spent using my Pixel C, for example, has been in airplanes exclusively watching Netflix because it just makes sense for that, and the keyboard works as a really nice stand. So it's like, I never had a problem with Android tablets from a content consumption standpoint. And Chrome OS to me, of Android versus Chrome OS has always been the content creation kind of window, in comparison to Android, at least for writing. For me, I mean, there's obviously different use cases. Obviously, Chrome OS is not very good for high level video production. But for, getting homework done as a college student or as a high school student or writing blog posts as your full-time job, which, it's kind of the situation we're in, that's kind of what Chrome OS is for. And so I'm sure the Chromebook tablet will be fine, and I'm sure future Chromebook tablets will be fine for content consumption because Android apps are getting, they're running so well on Chrome OS devices now that, you can run Netflix, you can run whatever, content consumption services you want, and it'll all work perfectly fine. And as a bonus, you have,
The full browser.
the full browser experience. So, I mean, I think it'll be fine, but for me, I'm fine with an Android tablet. I'm fine with my Pixel C, and I'm not really compelled to move from a Pixel C to a Chromebook Tab 10 for content consumption.
Presumably, there will be more Chrome OS tablets. And let's say one of those looked exactly like the Pixel C, but with running Chrome OS, and you had to choose, if you could choose modern, same hardware, what OS would you choose for?
Chrome OS, bar none, because you slap a keyboard on it with a keyboard accessory, just like the Pixel 3, or just like, not the Pixel 3, just like the Pixel C currently has, and you've got a full functioning Chromebook, which to me would be a really great device at $300 if that existed.
You bring up the awesome point of Chrome OS on tablets in a inadvertently possibly killing off Android OS for tablets, because why would you make an Android tablet in this day and age? Why would, like, the likes of Samsung and LG and Acer, those companies that still push out tablets, why would you have it run Android instead of Chrome OS?
Well, I don't really think there is a compelling reason, and that's why Android tablets are effectively dead in 2018. I mean, with the exception of Samsung, and I feel like the Samsung tabs are basically, you know, you go to a store and you've got the Apple tablet and then the not Apple tablet, and Samsung is the not Apple tablet. And so that's the market. The market is people who, you know, want an iPad, but they don't want to buy Apple because it's premium and they may be associated with high price, which it is, you know, it is, but you know, it's they, or they have other reasons for wanting something in the Android ecosystem because maybe they have already purchased 50 apps, you know, for some reason they may be averse to having an iPad. I think the iPad's the best tablet right now, you know, from an objective perspective, but if someone is averse to Apple or Apple's ecosystem for one reason or another, then the Samsung Tab is the Android alternative. But I don't know how much longer that's going to last, because even that, which I think previously was kind of a bigger but still not huge market, I think even Samsung's tablet business is, I don't have data to back this up, but I would guess that Samsung's tablet business is not exactly thriving.
Oh, it's very cheap. Like the most people get Fire tablets from Amazon because they're dirt right. cheap.
Exactly. That's the other Android tablet philosophy or product, is that you can throw Android on terrible hardware. I mean, objectively terrible hardware. You can put Android on a 9-inch or a 7-inch device that has the lowest end specs and call it, you know, an Android tablet, and you can sell it for $69.99 at Walmart. So, but I think what we've found is that even those devices, there's not enough compelling about having a 7-inch screen that makes people want those over just using their 5 or 6-inch smartphone that they already have in their pocket.
Yeah. In a way, you can make the argument that phablets are what really killed Android on tablets versus the lack of a real compelling experience from Google. Well, it's both of those things, to be honest.
Right. And Apple's not immune, because we've watched the iPad sales over the last 5 years not, you know, not the iPad's not really growing anymore.
The iPad's not the iPhone. It's not the next thing that everybody must have.
Well, yes, and the size of the iPhone has grown over that same time period, and like you're saying, the phablet, the iPhone 10 is a phablet, and the next iPhone 10, which I think is rumored to be even, there being even bigger, you know, an iPhone 11 Plus or whatever it'll be called, yeah. There'll be even more of a phablet version of it. You know, it's cannibalizing, especially the iPad mini, which, you know, at first was kind of very different from the 4-inch iPhone 5 that we had at the time, or 4 or whatever. But now, you know, there's very little reason, if you have an iPhone 11 Plus, to also own an iPad mini, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So, this first Chrome OS tablet was for education, and Apple had their education event this week. So, let's briefly, this Acer Chromebook Tab 10 is Chrome OS, and therefore it works with all the classroom management features that Google has built out in G Suite. This includes device management and the multiple services, Google Docs, Google Drive for students. And then there's Google Classroom, which is Google's direct management system for assigning, to allow teachers to assign homework, to do quick grading, to do autocorrect quizzes in Google Forms, all that. It works. It just works. And another thing they announced is coming soon are AR Expeditions, which is Apple made a big deal with augmented reality, and they're starting to build it out with ARKit. But before AR Core, Google has been working for a bit on something it calls AR Expeditions. It allows you to map the physical classroom and place 3D objects so that students can walk all around it, spot details. I'm pretty sure that Apple demoed something very similar, but Google has also had it. And another aspect is to take virtual field trips. in conjunction with Google Cardboard, a cheap augmented reality, a cheap virtual reality solution.
Yeah, I mean, I think you summed it up pretty well. I think that Google has all of the pieces in place to be a strong competitor in the education market.
If not the leader.
Yeah, I mean, we already know that that's true because all you have to do is look at the numbers and see that Chromebooks are by and large dominating devices that are used in the classroom K through 12. And I think that our colleague Bradley Chambers over at 9 to 5 Mac, you should read his article. Those who are listening to this podcast, you should head over to 9 to 5 Mac and read his article. He's an Apple fan. I mean, this is coming from 9 to 5 Mac. This is not 9 to 5 Google. This is a guy who is objectively a fan of Apple and all of its products, and he has no inherent bias against Apple. He wrote an article called Why Apple's Education Strategy is Not Based in Reality. And I completely agree with everything he's written. Primarily, to quote him, he says Google, app, they Apple should build a viable alternative to G Suite that makes it easy for schools to manage communications. They should do all of this at a price where the least affluent districts can deploy it as easily as the most affluent ones. And I just think that, he hits the nail on the head here saying that Apple just does not have the infrastructure in place to compete with what Google's offering with G Suite. Do you agree with that, Abner?
Definitely. And on the affluence point, Apple is a historically, they have had this, the moniker of the premium of the expensive, and that just doesn't work in education. With Google, whereas in comparison, Google, they are at a company that is obsessed with scale. They want to do everything in scale. And their approach has, we've seen from their approach that they're making Chrome OS a cheap thing. They're $200 Chromebooks, 169, I believe, that you can buy and use just as well as an iPad. You are, and I will grant you that you are lacking these fun things, but at the end of the day, it's for work, it's for getting things done, it's for education. And while those fun experiences might help, these cool augmented reality apps that developers can build can help, at the end of the day, you just want to focus on the brass tacks, on the doing and working.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word you're looking for is economical. I mean, the Chromebook in the context of education is just the definition of economical, and it is so attractive to school districts because, well, for multiple reasons, one of which being just the price. As you mentioned, they're sub $200, and I'm sure when these school districts buy them in bulks of hundreds or thousands of laptops, I'm sure they're getting prices even better than that. But Chromebooks, if we're talking strictly about the hardware itself, if we're talking about the hardware of a Chromebook laptop, let's say a Dell Chromebook for education, one of those 11 or 13-inch models. These laptops are, yes, affordable, but I mentioned this in a tweet that kind of went, semi-viral during or right after the Apple event, saying that Chromebooks are they're practical. They're generally more rugged than this slab of glass that Apple's trying to sell with the iPad, which is a big deal for the classroom. Anyone who's been in a classroom as a student, which is all of us, mostly all of us, and or been a teacher in a classroom knows that these devices get dropped like once a day. Every single device will get dropped once a day, and that's a, it's a problem for these school districts, especially when you've got a device that's, like an iPad, which is like 9, 10, whatever inches of glass, and all it takes is one drop to shatter the thing from, all the way across. And Chromebooks kind of help that situation because they're more modular and more easily repairable. I think some people kind of misinterpreted me and whenever what I was saying was as if I was suggesting that all Chromebooks are just super easy to repair, kind of like a desktop PC or something. They're obviously not that easy to repair. You can't just like open up the hood and, you know, take pieces out and replace them that easily. But they're more easily repairable than an iPad, for sure.
And and if worse comes to worse, you get a new one for $100 in bulk.
Right, exactly. And I think that one of the biggest problems that school districts have with devices is batteries. I mean, I remember as a kid, I remember those, I don't know if you remember this, but I think we're both young enough to have experienced, and at least in high school, those like laptop carts.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, you've got 25, 30 laptops or whatever in the cart and they're all charging. And, you know, I feel like, you know, back then, you know, I remember using Dell Chromebooks in high school and, you know, there was like, I felt like, maybe I'm exaggerating, but it felt like a 50% chance that the one I pulled out was either not charging properly or had a battery that was running out in an hour or whatever, or, you know, had other battery related issues. Mm-hmm. And Chromebooks, unlike iPads, easily solve that problem because a lot of them just have batteries that you can swap out. So if you're in IT, if you're working in IT in an elementary school and or middle school or high school, and your Chromebook runs out of battery, or you've got five Chromebooks with dead batteries that aren't charging correctly, you can just swap them out. And that's, I think, a big deal for these, you know, these IT organizations within school districts. And the other thing is, we've talked about this already, but just how much control these organizations have over Chrome OS versus iOS. I think Google gives a lot more flexibility for administration.
Definitely. That is the advantage of a cloud-first company.
Do you hear that?
Yes.
Something triggered my home in the other room. I don't know if we should leave this in the podcast or not, but one of my homes in the other room is like reading the news or something based on something I said.
How? I didn't hear anything vaguely similar.
I don't know, but it happens sometimes.
Oh, weird.
Google Home is not perfect.
Oh, there's just a ghost in your new place.
Yeah, I think another point to touch on, and you mentioned this, is that the iPads are kind of idealistic.
Yes, they. If you watch Apple's keynote, during the keynote, there were so many demos of really cool uses of augmented reality, of using augmented reality to teach and show models and demos. And I think this is the very platonic ideal of how fun education can be. But at the end of the day, those demo-y, bordering gimmicky things cater to much younger students. When you get into college and high school, and definitely high school, all you want to do is something like Google Docs to collaborate. You want a keyboard, which the new iPad doesn't have, but in fairness, this Chromebook 10 doesn't have either. But in general, what you want to do is work and type. And it's not sexy, it's not fun, but it's what you need to do in life for the college and the real world.
Right. I think the picture of this idealism that Apple has is the commercial for the new iPad. Did you see that?
Yes, I did.
And it's basically kids running around having fun and drawing on their iPads. And they're all elementary school kids, it looks like. So, I mean, in fairness, I think it makes more sense, you know, this idealistic idea of education being super interactive and fun and engaging. And, you know, I'm all for that, you know, from a philosophical standpoint. I definitely agree.
And in 20 years, it might get there.
Right. But I think right now, even in elementary school, whereas I think elementary school is probably the most,
you know, target like, for all this stuff.
Right. It's the target. But even in elementary school, I don't know if that's realistic today. But especially not in middle school and high school, where I think the majority of assignments that teachers are, you know, trying to assign and students are having to do is, you know, writing papers or making PowerPoints or, you know, something traditionally productive in the education system. I'm all for change and I'm all for progress, but I think that schools are more likely to look at which companies are meeting them where they are, rather than trying to paint a picture of an education system that might be 5 or 10 or 20 years away.
So that was a very deep dive from us on Chrome OS tablets and Apple's education events and Google's education focus. And we are very excited to try our first Chrome OS tablets whenever we get our review units in. What else happened this week, Stephen?
Well, we had the very first Wear OS dev preview, isn't that right? It brings Android P, a dark theme, and some smart battery saving features.
Android P, which just launched at the beginning of the month, and now it's available on smartwatches, which is pretty good turnaround for Google. So good job on that, and showing that Wear OS is more than just a rebrand. So with Android P, it restricts the use of non-SDK. That's definitely a developer focus. But on the appearance side, Google is moving to a more dark theme, which we've already begun to see with current versions of Android Wear just before the rebrand. And for Google, this, they say, it should improve the glanceability for Wear apps, which we definitely agree. But the very big focus of this developer preview was battery saving features.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned, you know, from one of our tipsters, we heard about a few features that were coming to Wear OS, one of them being what they called low energy mode, which we didn't really know how to define that, and we didn't really know what, you know, that could mean, considering Wear OS already has kind of a low battery kind of feature. But it turns out with this Wear OS developer preview, we're seeing a lot of features that are about, you know, handling low battery or low energy situations with watches, and I guess with the end goal of extending watch battery as much as possible.
Definitely. So just quickly recapping. So when you're not wearing a watch for an extended period of time, Google's words, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, and the cellular radios shut down. Another thing they're doing is they no longer connect you to Wi-Fi when Bluetooth is disconnected. This is another battery-saving feature. And lastly, and most interesting for some apps, is that they're no longer allowed to run in the background unless the watch is charging. Google is very much limiting for the benefit of battery life, and at the end of the day, I think consumers will much prefer this.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's weird, though, that the one very odd thing with this developer preview is that of all the watches, Google is launching it, or it's compatible as of today, with just the Huawei Watch 2, and not its kind of flagship devices that it launched last year, the LG Watch Sport and LG Watch Style. Isn't that kind of odd?
Yeah, the old developer preview was available on the Sport, I believe. But I have a mini theory on this, on why they chose Huawei. So, Wear OS and Android Wear before it was one of the Android products that was vaguely officially available in China. They had this whole runaround, they had this tweak that where Google Play services wasn't being used on the watch and to use other alternatives and local Chinese services. So I'm wondering, because this week's developer preview had a Wear OS developer preview for China, I'm wondering if there's some working together on that front. But yeah, in general, Google, you're reaving out your flagships.
Yeah, I have an alternative theory on that. I think that with a developer preview, Google would want to have this Wear OS build in as many hands as possible. And so perhaps the Huawei Watch 2 is the best convergence of modern device, which it is, you know, comparatively speaking, and ubiquity, or I guess how many devices are actually out there. I guess Google may have found that there's way more Huawei Watch 2s out there than there are LG Watch Sports. So maybe they just decided, okay, well, we can only focus on optimizing this developer preview for one watch at a time, so we should probably pick the watch that most people have sitting in drawers. Note, not actually wearing on their wrists, rather sitting in drawers, because this is Wear OS we're talking about.
Sigh. Yep, the state of Wear OS today.
All right, with that out of the way, I mean, I don't really think I have any really big thoughts on that. We'll just have to see where Wear OS goes in the coming months and weeks. It'll be really interesting to see what happens at Google I.O. and then later this year when Google has their hardware event to see if there's any more developments in this area. What other notable stories did we have this week, Abner?
So, on talking about the smart home again, Google Home added Bluetooth pairing. So you could already pair your phone to your speaker and stream music that's on your phone over Bluetooth, but now all your Google Home devices can connect to another Bluetooth speaker so that you can expand the sound, which makes a lot of sense for the Home Mini. But even cooler is how you can do multi-room audio over Bluetooth with this setup. So instead of requiring a Google Cast device or Chromecast, you can just now stream over Bluetooth. While it's probably not as good, it's cheap, affordable, and it's a very nice feature for Google Home.
So are there any limits on how many Bluetooth speakers can be paired to an individual Google Home?
We're unsure at the moment, but one example that Google mentioned was being able to listen to a podcast while you're walking around the house and have it play on various speakers, Bluetooth speakers. So I think it's pretty ambitious, and hopefully so.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I'm just imagining this theoretically, that you could have like one Google Home in one room and then have four or five Bluetooth speakers in different rooms. I'm not sure if it's that ambitious or if this is more just Google thinking, like one or two Bluetooth speakers per home. Also, do we know if you can pair multiple Bluetooth speakers to multiple Google Homes and have all of them across? So if I had one Google Home with three Bluetooth speakers synced up to it, and then another Google Home in another side of the house with three more Bluetooth speakers synced up to it, could I have all eight, I guess, of those speakers all group pairing, or would it be limited to four and four? Do you know?
It might be limited to four and four, just as the restriction of Bluetooth as a standard today.
Yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to test that out whenever it rolls out and see how everything works.
Relatedly, how's your smart home?
So I'm actually just set up my office, and I'm going to post about that later on 9to5 Toys in our Behind the Screen series, but I got my Philips Hue lights all set up in my office, so I'm excited about that. This is my first experience with Philips Hue, and it's really cool to, you know, change the temperature and the color of your lights throughout the day to kind of match your mood, or match, you know, in the mornings I'll, you know, lean blue in the colors, and in the afternoons I'll lean orange, and it kind of, you know, it's like having flux for your office. And then also today, actually, I mean, FedEx guy may be at my door right now for all I know. I should be receiving a Nest Protect and a Nest Cam Indoor, not the Nest Cam IQ. I've got a Nest Cam IQ in my office looking at me right now, you know, spying on me, because we're talking about Google. But I have a Nest Cam, not IQ, on the way, just because I've never used one and I'm interested to try it out and compare it and contrast to IQ. And then the Protect, I'm getting the battery-powered model, and it's going to live in my kitchen and replace the decades-old smoke detector that I have in there. So I'm excited. I mean, I'm probably going to have a couple more posts coming this upcoming week about, you know, my ongoing experience. But so far with my Nest Thermostat and Nest Secure, it's already gotten to the point where, you know, they're just part of my life, I think, at this point. And it's a really nice feeling knowing that if anyone breaks in, or if anyone opens a door that's not supposed to be opened or something, it's really cool that I can have a notification on my phone within a few minutes. That's my main takeaway with Nest Secure. Nest Thermostat, it's really hot in here right now. I could probably say hot word, you know, turn the thermostat down to 71 or something like that. And my Google Home Mini, which is a room away, has good enough microphones that it would probably pick me up. And, you know, that's just like a convenience, a first world convenience that I'm still getting used to. I'm realizing that I don't have to walk across the house to change the temperature, and that's weird. But you know, slowly but surely, I'm getting used to it, and Nest is becoming part of my life. And I'll have more thoughts later.
Nice. I look forward to reading those diaries. So, in app news this week, it was a big week for the Google Play family. Google Play Movies and TV added this new feature where it becomes a centralized repository of where everything is streaming. So you can still look at listings in the app, but let's say if you go to Silicon Valley, the show, it'll say that it's streaming on HBO. And you can do this with anything, with other TV shows and even movies. And it's a really convenient feature, and it makes Google Play Movies so much more useful than just the place where you buy content from Google Play and watch. Meanwhile, Play Books, which launched its audiobooks feature back in January, adds a cool smart resume feature where when you pause, it automatically goes back to the start of the sentence. You can now bookmark sections in an audiobook, and you have more options with the speed controls, so you can listen very slowly at 0.5 or really quickly at 3x. Meanwhile, last weekend we spotted that starting with Chrome 65 and above, the incognito mode blocks screenshots. You can no longer take screenshots, which is some people don't like, but I think it really makes sense. Furthermore, in Android's recent view, when you're in incognito mode with Chrome, it now shows as a blank tab. So that's another good security feature. Meanwhile, on YouTube for Android, Google is finally rolling out the dynamic video player, where square video shows up in a square window, and the same thing with vertical. That made its way on iOS in December, and it's really good for how some people are watching content these days. So that is it on the app front.
Thanks for that roundup, Abner. It's definitely been a big week in the app update world. But I guess with Google, every week is a big week. Unfortunately, or I guess fortunately, depending on how you see things, we haven't seen any updates this week that brought April Fool's jokes.
Yeah, since April Fool's is on Sunday this week, April 1st, we thought that Google would be doing its jokes this Friday, but so far, nothing has happened yet. The Google Twitter account teased it, but again, nothing. So
yeah, I'm not really sure what's going to happen, given that, you know, this is Easter weekend and April 1st is landing on a Sunday this year. As you've mentioned before, Google employees kind of need to be around to fix any problems that might arise from, you know, these pranks. So I think it seems likely that we might see less directly feature-related jokes and maybe more witty blog posts. And maybe we're going to have to wait till tomorrow before we see anything pop up.
Yeah, they definitely need engineers on hand. So last year, one joke was in Gmail, and it was called a mic drop feature. So when you're sending an email, one of the buttons is just send an archive, or send plus mic drop. This little gem adds a GIF to every email you sent of the minions in the Despicable Me franchise dropping a mic, like a gif of somebody dropping a mic, of a minion dropping a mic. And it's funny. It's a funny gif. But as many people pointed out, this is a horrible idea. And this is...
yeah, someone called it a betrayal of trust, because I think there were definitely several examples of one person who, this is so like terrible, but like one person was sending an email related to a funeral and accidentally sent using the mic drop feature. And then there was another person who apparently on the Google forum, someone said that they had been applying to, you know, several jobs, and they finally got an email back and they accidentally sent their resume using this mic drop gif. And so they were rightfully very infuriated that this little April Fool's joke, which I think philosophically April Fool's jokes should be harmless.
I think that's a baseline.
Yeah, right. And I think Google proved with this feature that they can sometimes do harm. You know, do no evil, right? Or don't be evil. I think they realize that they can accidentally be evil sometimes.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure you're probably right that it's going to be a lot of witty blog posts and videos this year round.
Yeah, maybe we'll have some April Fool's hijinks to talk about on next week's show. And I think that wraps it up. So thanks, as always, for joining me, Abner.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners.
And thanks to everyone that tuned into this third episode of Alphabet Scoop. We record this every Friday and publish every Saturday morning, and you can find us in Google Play, iTunes and Apple's podcast app, Pocket Casts, Google App Podcasts, and anywhere else you might listen to podcasts. We'll see you next week.
Thanks.